thank you. Look, thank you very much. And when we convened, when we planned the symposium, and when we convened this panel and called it Politics and Ethics, it really could have been the title for most of the presentations today and tomorrow. And coming back to the discussion we had in the second session and Nicola's argument that we need to talk about the fundamentals, I think a lot of what you're going to hear in the course of this next hour is going to tie in with what we heard this morning. As also the convener of this panel, I can make the announcement that the second presentation, the presentation by José Manuel da Costa, Esteve is going to say something about this after I finish with mine. This session's title, Politics and Ethics, really could be the title for most of the presentations today and tomorrow. As mentioned in my opening remarks earlier today, dealings with intellectual property and with rights holders are the bread and butter and sometimes the dread of film archives. Striking a balance between the professional standards of the archive, articulated, for example, in FIAF's Code of Ethics, and the requirements of the broader marketplace for cultural products. I'll avoid lecturing here about the numerous particular issues faced by the NFSA as the keeper and communicator of a national audiovisual collection. My colleagues Bronwyn and Siobhan tomorrow will provide numerous and better, and I'm sure much more entertaining, examples from the coal face of working in collection reference and access to collections. And you would have seen in the presentations earlier today from Nicola, from Greg and Hope, Todd and Chris, and of course from Rick's lecture, that if there is a will, there is a way to achieve results through negotiation, through begging, through borrowing, and sometimes through stealing. However, and this is where the politics come into play, as previous presenters said, the constant exception is not an acceptable solution, particularly for public service and government organizations. Neither is stealing, for a very obvious reason. So how can we then do the right thing by our very diverse patron and stakeholder groups? Undoubtedly, the biggest factor influencing legal and ethical debates in the last decade is the transformative power that, and this is all about the language, the word digitization has, not necessarily the technical process of digitization. Because it's not only about technical processes, but it is also about a fundamental transformation about how we perceive cultural artifacts, creation, and works of art. National audiovisual archives like the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia, and I'm speaking on behalf of the National Film and Sound Archive, and I'm not as Secretary General now, find themselves in a very strange position. On the one hand, and in a forum like this, we feel we need to explain very little about the uniqueness of our operations. And this might be a problem that we think it's also obvious that we don't need to talk about it. Film archives, non-for-profits and commercial entities alike, I dare to say, operate always under special conditions. We are special. We are really complicated. We are complex. Our holdings are uniquely complex. They demand bespoke and handcrafted solutions. Outside these walls, however, I find myself constantly arguing how we are not like Google, or why we don't, quote, let Google do that digitization thing for you, and why they can't do the right thing and ensure that a clip from a TV show, for instance, a rare handmade 16mm film, a home movie shot of the liberation of the concentration camps in 1945, is freely available in a convenient format and location, for example, on YouTube. Why can't we do that? That's what we in Australia here call the barbecue test. Can you actually explain what you do when somebody approaches you at a barbecue and asks you exactly that question? Explaining the complexity of legal issues, a film, and in our case, a sound and broadcast archive, and I found it interesting that we talked about television twice this morning, faces in its mission to collect, preserve, and share audiovisual heritage, usually earns you incredulous looks, the dreaded, really? It's that complicated? Glazed eyes, as in, you're talking legal issues, I'm not going to listen to you. Or even worse, indifference, Because as Nicola said, do we really matter? Does anybody give a toss, as we say here? With a few notable exceptions, most of our audiences, users, and patrons are blissfully unaware of the often arcane, outdated, and prohibitive copyright framework we operate under here in Australia, and I'm going to talk about the Australian example. The undoubtedly biggest statement FIAF has made in recent years about archives' management of intellectual property is the FIAF Fair Access Declaration, adopted by the FIAF General Assembly at the Paris Congress in 2008. It's worthwhile, at the beginning of this session, I reckon, to be able to reread, behind me here on the screen, key statements from the declaration. Even if some of us, for legislative reasons in our home countries or in the legislation that we under that we operate under as incorporated entities, cannot, without a conflict of interest, fully adhere to these principles. However, I think we all are wary of more cynical debates that say this code of this declaration of fair access is not worth the paper it was printed on because nobody pays attention to it anyway. I think that's a dangerous argument. The political process is one way of addressing the gap between reality and aspiration. And we heard today about individual agreements. We heard about a memoranda of understanding. We heard about, in the presentation, in Greg's part of the presentation, about this exact political process of influencing legislative reform. A recent review by the Australian Law Reform Commission enabled the NFSA to comment on some of the blockages we face under current legislation and operating in what the inquiry called the digital economy. I'll briefly elaborate on two aspects of archival work and how they are affected by these processes and the amendments or positions that the NFSA proposed in the course of the consultation. And a lot of what I'm going to say now basically paraphrases or picks individual elements of a paper that we produced in response to this inquiry. And a lot of what I'm going to present here owes its existence to our principal legal officer, Adam Flynn, who's sitting back there and who's going to moderate the panel later today. So I'm going to use some of your words, Adam. The two aspects that I'm going to face, that I'm going to focus on is preservation copying, because that seems to be one of the less contentious ones, and then access, and access with a particular example. So now for preservation copying. The NFSA, in our response to the copyright reform discussion, supported the introduction of a new copyright exception that permits cultural institutions to make copies of, and this is the important difference, any copyright material for the purposes of preservation without limits on format or number. So existing exceptions that are part of a bundle of sometimes arcane and outdated individual sections of the Copyright Act are not format agnostic. They talk about specific formats, and specific formats that are largely obsolete. They also place a limit on the numbers of copies you can make, which in a digital environment is completely against all of the better practice models that FIAF, for instance, the Technical Commission, recommends. Preservation of collections, we argued, is fundamental to cultural institutions. Preservation of material by cultural institutions is in the best interests of the general public and this is the proposition, of the copyright holder. Preservation benefits future generations as their cultural history may otherwise become unavailable. One of the possible amendments the NFSA strongly opposed was that any new preservation copying exception should contain a requirement that it does not apply to copyright material that, and I'm quoting from the proposal by the Law Reform Commissioner, copyright material that can be commercially obtained within a reasonable time at an ordinary commercial price. And I think that's interesting compared with what we see in other legislations, including examples that you presented earlier. Why did we object this? Our objection was, in principle, preservation activities by cultural institutions are for the benefit of the public as well as for creators. Preservation of copyright material by cultural institution is likely to increase the potential market value of copyright material rather than adversely impact it. we add value by preserving, we invest public resources that adds value to the work. Furthermore, the wording, and I repeat, commercially can be commercially obtained within a reasonable time at an ordinary commercial price, is frankly really, really ambiguous. I'm not even talking about the waste of time of staff that is paid by the taxpayer to undertake so-called availability tests. What is a reasonable time and what is an ordinary commercial price? There is a precedent for more appropriate commercial availability tests in international preservation exceptions, and we just touched upon two of them. For example, the UK copyright law restricts replacement copying, as it is called, and I'm quoting, to cases where it is not practicable to purchase a copy to fulfill that purpose. So basically, this puts the authority to define what is actually doable, what is practicable, what is within resources, as well as what is actually a suitable copy. It puts the authority back to the archive and not to some very unclear authority. Also, in Canadian copyright law, the exception for libraries, archives, and museums to copy for management and maintenance of collections does not apply where, and I'm quoting, appropriate copy is commercially available in a medium and of a quality that is appropriate. So again, an approach that puts the authority to define what is actually the suitable long-term preservation format, what is the most sustainable format, back to the archives and back to potentially our collection policies and international best practice recommendations. Just because a film is available in a telecine or in a HD transfer that was produced commercially by a rights holder or through the exploitation chain, does not impact our ability to perform photochemical duplication or to scan it in 2K, 4K, or whatever format are to be invented in the future. That's an important point that we raised in the consultation with the Law Reform Commissioner, and I must say one of the ones that was received more warmly than others. Access, and access is, as you would imagine, access was the number one priority in this inquiry because, as we said in the morning, all of the initiatives around reform of copyright legislation either stem from a market that seeks to be able to retain the ability to increase the reach of their product exponentially, or by the idea that societies will benefit from the more efficient and free communication of information. You may call it neo-Marxist or neoliberal. I also suspect that there is an uncanny resemblance sometimes of these concepts, but I'm not going to go there. The NFSA, when it comes to access, and I'm going to start with internal access and then move to external access, recommended the introduction of a specific copyright exception to guarantee the provision of on-site access to collections, regardless of the format. Cultural institutions would still consider donor and rights holder wishes, and in the case of the Australian collecting institutions and the National Film and Sound Archive, that particularly includes Indigenous cultural and intellectual property rights. And we may restrict access accordingly. However, according to our principles, according to our curatorial charters and best practice recommendations. Most collection material in Australia's other national cultural institutions, museums, art galleries, etc., can easily be displayed in public without requiring copyright permissions or a license. For example, displaying an artwork, an object, an artifact, unless there is cultural, there's cultural protocols attached to it. However, the very nature of audiovisual material, where in order to exhibit, to display, to make visible the object, for example, a film or a sound recording, or also a website or a work of intermedia art, in order to display the object, it must be screened, so it must be, in the lingo, performed and communicated to actually be visible. Moreover, depending on the original material, the item must often be copied to a different format, so format shifted, in order for it to be used. All actions that are not supported in a legislation that was drafted decades ago. screening, performing, and communicating audiovisual material in Australia generally is subject to seeking permissions and or paying license fees to either distributors or to collecting societies. So collecting societies, I think the term used in the previous session was societies of authors, of producers, of directors. So proxies that stand between the creator and the actual exploitation chain. So we either need to seek permission or pay license fees, and in many instances we need to do both. This means the NFSA is almost always required to undertake expensive and expansive research and clearance or pay for licenses simply to show its collection to the Australian taxpayer who pay for it. The NFSA, and I'm going to use an example that begins to blur the lines between what is on-site access and what is off-site access, if you want, operates an access center, and if you want, an audiovisual reading room, to use the library metaphor, or a viewing room called the Australian Mediatheque in collaboration with and situated at ACME, so the Australian Centre of the Moving Image in Melbourne. ACME are a FIAF associate, and I'm very happy to see my friend and colleague Katrina Sedgwick, who started in the job as ACME's new director and CEO, I think not even 2 months ago, here with us to introduce you to our FIAF to our FIAF constituency. So please give a warm hand of welcome to Katrina. So we operate this Australian Mediatheque together and have been doing this for a number of years, which is an audiovisual reading or viewing room. We only include material in the Australian Mediatheque where a license is available, which many rights holders have actually been very happy to provide. However, it doesn't take away from the task of actually doing the research, doing the due diligence, negotiating an individual, however, template-based agreement. If a rights holder cannot be contacted, or if for whatsoever reason does not agree, the item is not included, except in very rare cases that they might be of a low risk or a low risk orphan, which probably has more to do with our sometimes lack of risk appetite than with the actual potential adverse action. This limits the amount and variety of material that can be accessed in the spirit of the NFSA's enabling legislation. It can, in extreme cases, and although it is a carefully curated program, actually lead to only very specific parts of the National Audiovisual Collection being visible and therefore distorting the idea of the diversity of Australia's audiovisual heritage, which is a curatorial issue. There are a number of exceptions in New Zealand's Copyright Act of 1994, for example, that allow film, television, and radio archives to publicly play collection material without infringing copyright, subject to the availability of a license, including Section 57 of the New Zealand Copyright Act, and it's one of my favorite copyright acts, playing or showing sound recordings or films. Ngatanga, the organization you used to know as the New Zealand Film Archive, states that the institution can present material publicly without copyright clearance if presented by a film archive staff member. And I find that remarkable, and I think it is a worthwhile conversation then to have. How does that, Rebecca, acting CEO who's here with us and a lot of our friends from Ngatanga, how that actually plays out in practice? We are eager to hear more about that. The NFSA considers that an exception like this for the Australian context, to use items from the National Audiovisual Collection and related materials, would be a very appropriate solution. This would extend to the showing of materials in the NFSA cinema, for instance, and at other locations arranged by the NFSA. It would also increase our risk appetite to challenge the notion of what on-site really is. The Mediatheque, for example, and this is where I end my argument, currently consists of video screens and a server playback system that is a fixed installation. So you are an audience that is in a particular physical location. But what if another model, and Katrina and I commenced conversations around this, for example, based on Wi-Fi technology or on Bluetooth technology, based on mobile devices, or even, dare I say, bring your own device models, where a Mediatheque extends beyond a fixed place and actually plays out into public spaces, pop-up access centers, for instance, which can be set up anywhere, including here in the foyer where we have our tea break, and operate under a bring-your-own-device policy. I again remind you of the Fair Access Declaration, paragraph 10, and its provision for what is here called fee of affiliates declare their right to engage in the following archive-related activities without the payment of fees, exhibition on their premises. So where are our premises? And we used to make a joke when I worked in Vienna that anywhere where we set up camp and said, this is a film museum on location screening, it is actually our premises. And back in Vienna, we were very proud supporters of a fair access clause saying, we are not going to do clearances for this, something I can't do in the current context. Look, participating in the political process might be the longer road. Sometimes stealing and sometimes bending the rules and sometimes just ducking and covering might look like a quick fix. In the end, it is probably not. There's also always there's consultation with the industry. Nicola talked about how productive that can be. However, it sometimes achieves results. And last but not least, there is the societies of authors who are very quick sometimes to come to us and say, we offer you what they call bespoke licensing agreements. You tell us your problem, we find a commercial license solution. For various reasons, we are very skeptical of that. We'll hear more about other long-term solutions, including industry consultation from our colleagues now, and thank you for your attention.